I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 168 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast apps. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show, you can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And now, since we have a long interview this week with Dr. Nancy Banks, let's get to it. Nancy Banks is an MD who graduated from Harvard Medical School. She worked in the area of organ transplantation as a medical student intern, and then practiced as a certified obstetrician and gynecologist for 25 years. Previously, she wrote AIDS, Opium, Diamonds, and Empire. She's lectured many times on the dangers of the mad mainstream medical model. She worked with the Office of Medical and Scientific Justice in defense of people charged with HIV felonies, which had a track record of over 50 exonerations or sentence reductions before it was shut down, hopefully not forever. Today's interview was stimulated by my purchase of her 2016 book, The Slow Death of the AIDS Cancer Paradigm, subtitled The Apocrypha of the Eukaryotic Cell. So you got a lot of words you're going to have to explain there. Yeah. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with eukaryotic, because that's important to understand, and I would hazard a guess that 99% of people don't know what a eukaryote is.
Yeah, they're basically cells that have a nucleus which is enclosed by a membrane, and cells which have nuclear material which is not enclosed by a membrane. And eukaryotic cells are those cells which have the nuclear material is enclosed by a membrane. And those are the kinds of cells which are in the human beings and in most of the population that we're going to talk about, the cells of our body. And also it's very important because it has to do with how our cells were evolved. The cells,
right.
The eukaryotic cell was, in fact, evolved from the prokaryotic cells, the cells without a nuclear membrane.
Okay, well, let's talk about what are some examples of prokaryotic cells.
Well, bacteria. Most bacteria are prokaryotic cells.
So they have a membrane and they have genetic material, but the genetic material is not enclosed within a membrane.
Exactly. They have an outer membrane protecting them, but they do not have an inner membrane protecting the genetic material.
Okay. And so I believe it was Lynn Margulis who came up with the theory that the eukaryotic cell is actually a sort of social organism, a symbiosis of multiple organisms.
Right. The importance of this is when you look at the evolution of the Earth in the atmosphere of the Earth, the early cells, the basic prokaryotic cells, were able to utilize the atmosphere and the water that existed on the Earth to make energy. But it was a low energy process. So these cells used an energy-making process that largely consisted of something that we call glycolysis. And as they became more complex, as these two prokaryotic cells combined to eventually become the eukaryotic cell, the membrane, the genetic material was enclosed by a membrane. And one of the reasons that occurred is because these cells were making more energy and they had more what we call oxidation materials. And these oxidants were more damaging. And so it was thought that the membrane occurred in order for the cell to carry out these higher order functions. But in order to carry out the higher order functions, they created more trauma to the cells.
And I think it's also another thing that probably a lot of people don't know, although they may have been taught this in high school biology, is that there are other, what we call organelles, within the cell that contain their own DNA, and I'm thinking of mitochondria. So can you describe those?
Right. The importance of the symbiosis that Lynn Margulis talks about is this. Once these two cells combined, they had to find a way, because one cell used the low energy method of creating energy and the other cell was using a high energy oxidative method of creating energy. So they had to, it was thought that the encircling the DNA in the envelope was a way of protecting the DNA of both of these cells. And as a part of the combination, the mitochondria, which initially was a cell in itself, and it was using the what we call oxidative phosphorylation to create energy, it transferred almost all of its DNA to the central nucleus, and it only kept a portion of its DNA to make those molecules which were necessary for producing an energy compound, which is called ATP. So most of the DNA of this combined organism is contained in the central DNA. But the interesting thing, when you really study the DNA, you realize that even though the DNA was transferred to the central nucleus, the central nucleus still behaves as if it is responding to two different species, because it responds to different signaling mechanisms. The ancient DNA responds to a lower energy signaling, and it has to do with lower energy processes such as replication and transcription of the DNA, and then the other DNA responds to higher order processes such as the cell metabolism and the processes that keep the cell growing and alive during its process of living.
Right, and the mitochondria basically are the energy regulators in the cells. They produce the energy currency that the rest of the cell uses, right?
Well, that's a bit of a fallacy. They produce the most ATP, but the cell itself is a dynamic, energetic system. The entire cell produces energy. And this is one of the problems that is currently extant in the biological field, because they are still teaching that ATP is the predominant molecule, but it takes about 14 kilocalories to produce an ATP. And when ATP is used up, it expends about the same amount. So if you look at ATP and you say ATP is the molecule of energy, then what you're saying is that the cell is essentially dead, because if you have an equal energy input and output, there's nothing left over to run the cell. So since the 1950s, they've known that ATP could not possibly be the amount of the energy for the cell. So where is the energy coming from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the energy is coming from, you know, what we call reactive oxygen species, which have been, you know, people say that these reactive oxygen species cause damage. But another role for them is in cell signaling and cell energy, because every time an electron goes from one level of energy to another level of energy, a photon is given off, and that photon can be used and stored. The other thing that we haven't talked about, and that's very important, that is being overlooked, is water molecules. Water molecules, Gerald Pollack out of California has been doing some incredible research on how the energy, the one electron oxygen reduction of energy of water is used to create energy within the cell. And the other thing, here in Mexico, there's a physician in Aguascalientes who has been working with melatonin, and he's discovered that melatonin has the same properties as chlorophyll. That is that it chlorophyll uses the energy of the sun to be able to split water, to be able to use as energy. And melatonin in humans has the same potential.
And, of course, black people have a lot more melatonin, right?
Right. But also everyone, but almost everyone has the same amount of melatonin in the areas of the brain. For example, one of the problems with people who have Parkinson's disease is a decrease in melatonin. And so one of the treatments that people have been using somewhat successfully has been melatonin. But I want to get back to the energy.
Can I just correct one thing? I believe Pollack is at the University of Washington, not in California, just in case people try to find him and his work.
Sorry. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Because everything on the West Coast to me is California.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just important. If somebody does a search and they find Pollack at University of Washington, they might think it's the wrong guy. But
okay.
And he published a book, something called Gels, Souls, something else, which describes his theories about water.
Right. He's done some wonderful work, and they have been having some really good conferences on water and the role of water in the energy metabolism of the cell. What is the importance of this? The importance of this is that almost all of this biochemistry and biophysics has been overlooked in the push to act as if the DNA, the central nucleus, was the defining sine qua non of the eukaryotic cell. And so almost all of the research today has been focused on the central nucleus, without understanding that the central nucleus is a chimera made up of two different bacteria from early evolution, and that it responds to different signals. And without an understanding of the energetic push of how the DNA expresses itself in proteins, we'll never have an understanding of how these different metabolic processes actually present as diseases. Well, one of the reasons they were wrong is because the model of the cell that they have been using historically has been the prokaryotic cell, the cell that doesn't have a nucleus. And they've been trying to transfer that information to the eukaryotic cell, the cell that does have a nucleus. But as we have just described, the eukaryotic cell is much more complex. And so that you cannot use the sample of the prokaryotic cell to predict how the eukaryotic cell is going to react under the same circumstances. Right. It's not so much the right place or the wrong place, but it's the matter of amount. And this is where the theory of the antioxidants, the balance of the cell, the cells stay in balance because there's enough energy being produced to make the cell produce the molecules that it needs to produce. And then ultimately, if the cell needs to divide, there's enough energy for the cell division and for the organism to grow. And so the issue with reactive oxygen species is this, and this is a very important theory. The theory is that we are taking in too many toxins into our bodies. As a result, these toxins have to be detoxed by the molecules in our cells. If we cannot get enough antioxidants, those things that will prohibit the cells from reacting negatively, then the cells are out of balance, and that is when we begin to express that as diseases. So it's not so much where these oxidizing agents go, but it's a fact, it's the issue of balance. Are we getting enough antioxidants? And this is crucial in today's world because we're surrounded from the time we're born. In the United States, the minute a baby is born, they are given vaccines. The air is contaminated with many kinds of things. For example, they're finally beginning to talk about chemtrails, which are also loaded with aluminum, which are the vaccines as well. Then we have things like glyphosate, which is, well, what exactly, especially the, and people have a tendency to forget that our major immune system is in our intestinal system, which is where this glyphosate is going to go. But one of the things that I found interesting, because the book basically talks a little bit about cancer, about AIDS, but I also have been researching autism and any number of other chronic diseases. And what I have found, one of the things that seems to be common across all of these is that they all seem to be related to this imbalance between oxidants and antioxidants. And one of the common antioxidants, especially in AIDS patients very early on, they found out that was the deficiency in a tripeptide 3 proteins called glutathione, which has a sulfur moiety. And in autism, one of the things that they are finding that they're low in glutathione, they're low in sulfate as well. And that the in autism, the aluminum attacks the pineal gland, and the pineal gland makes melatonin sulfate, and it's melatonin sulfate that is able to detoxify these metals from the brain. And so what I'm finding is that once you understand the metabolism of the cell, it's much easier, it's much easier to understand the processes that are going on in multiple diseases, because really they're not, they then don't become a lot of multiple diseases. They become a cellular imbalance, and it's much easier to figure out how to rebalance the cell.
Okay. Is it possible to have too many antioxidants? You
sure,
talked about balance.
For example, for example, what are some of the antioxidants? Many of the vitamins, the exogenous vitamins that we take in, can be antioxidants. And can you overdo taking too many of these vitamins? The answer is yes, you can. But the question is, when does that happen? Because one of the things that we found, especially in northern climates, almost everybody is deficient in vitamin D. Many, many people are deficient in vitamin C. We know from having to give our pregnant women folate that folic acid is a very common deficiency problem. And so we already know that in many parts of the world, and including the West, which has options for a lot of different food sources, that people are still deficient in the vitamins and antioxidants that they need to be balanced.
Okay, but so you're saying it'd be highly unlikely to be overdosing on these things. Much more likely that we have a lack of antioxidants as opposed to too many.
Yeah, I went to a conference a few years ago, and it was really interesting because it was at maybe about 8 or 9 years ago, and already it was, and I had just gone to a lecture at the National Institute of Health about vitamin D deficiency and the level of vitamin D deficiency and its relationship to multiple diseases, including cancers. And so the person who was giving the lecture was saying that, was recommending higher doses of vitamin D than the FDA was recommending, much higher doses. And And interestingly enough, I went to my endocrinologist because I have a thyroid problem, and she did my vitamin D level, and I was really, really low. And I was amazed at how low I was. And she was one of the few doctors at the time who were actually doing it. And so in order to replace me, she put me on mega doses for a couple of months and then reduced it. And so a lot of the doctors weren't doing that. But anyway, I went to this conference and I said, you know, we do know that so many people have a vitamin D deficiency. And so the response of these people from the CDC and the FDA was, well, it's dangerous. We can't just tell people to go on vitamin D. And I'm going, like, are you people kidding me? You're the people who put Vioxx and all of these drugs on the market that are killing people and giving people heart attacks, but you can't recommend vitamin D, which doesn't harm people.
Right. Whenever I hear mainstream medicine people saying something is dangerous, I think of the paper in JAMA that I think it looked at the year 1998 and found 106,000 people were killed in America every year by properly prescribed pharmaceuticals in hospitals. So that's a pretty restrictive definition. And I was talking to somebody about sauerkraut, and it's obviously a natural fermented product, and if it's done right, theoretically, maybe it could make you sick or even kill you. But how many people a year die from
sauerkraut
or homemade beer or wine that went wrong, or making or drinking raw milk? Like you might be able to find one or two people, but you got 106,000 people. So I'm thinking, well, until we get up to those kinds of levels, you know, when there's 10,000 people dying from sauerkraut poisoning, then yeah, we need to take it as seriously as prescription drugs. I mean, obviously.
But this is the brainwashing that's done, because doctors they're trained in order not to think about that. They're trained not to think that they, in fact, are they and the pharmaceutical companies combined are the third leading cause of death in the United States.
I'm not sure I agree with you on that. There are people who say it's the first leading cause of death, the leading cause of death.
I think it's the first.
We'll go with...
I'm using the numbers that you quoted to make it the third. So I agree with you. I think it's the first leading. I truly do.
Which is pretty sad. I mean, I also think that there are obviously people whose lives are saved by medicine, but it's like medicine, which is really good at patching people together after a war, after an industrial accident, after a car accident, after whatever. This very successful system has sort of broadened to cover things that it's not very good at. Like people who feel sad are diagnosed as ill with something that requires a pill to be fixed.
Well, I agree with you, and I think that is the biggest problem in the so-called health care system, which is really a disease care system, that we don't have. There's no competition among the different types of medicine. And most people don't. And I talk to a lot of so-called educated people, and they don't even realize that there are more options to health care. You know, they have no idea that there's Ayurvedic medicine, there's naturopathic medicine, there's homeopathic medicine, there's osteopathy, naturopathy. They don't know that these things are available, and in some states they have outlawed them.
Yes.
But, and so you are mandated on almost worldwide now to be the only thing that you have available to you is the allopathic system. And the allopathic system was never started to really be a benefit to humans. It was actually started by the oil oligarchs who wanted to make a lot of money, because they knew that by patenting medicine, they could sell almost anything to the American people and make an enormous amount of money off of it because they had a patent on it.
And we're going to talk about AIDS. one of the, I recently looked up, I think it was on a U.S. government website, so pretty, you know, reliable for this kind of thing. They had the prices for the latest drug cocktails, and I believe they were up to about $30,000 a year. Now, I'm thinking many of those cocktails are one pill a day, and I'm trying to think, like, what would it actually, what would the real cost be for a pill like that? I mean, putting aside whether it's got toxic effects and whether it's really needed or not, but how much would it really cost? I can't even come up with $100, and they're selling it for $30,000. So the profit margins on chemicals are mind-blowing.
Are truly mind-blowing.
Like, yeah. you can't grow food and get like a 10,000% margin on it unless, you know, you've got some super exotic food that's going to be purchased by five billionaires to eat it at some super expensive restaurant. But for the average person, you cannot get those profit margins. Yet with drugs, a huge percentage of the population is medicated in one way or another for depression or AIDS or to prevent heart disease or something like that.
So until the population really comes to grips with the fact that this is the real underlying reason this particular type of medicine was chosen, it's going to be very difficult to sell them on other ways of therapies. But the exciting thing about getting away from the DNA model and going to the energetic model of metabolism is that now what I'm beginning to see is that researchers all over the globe are now beginning to look at substances that are lacking that can be added that actually can balance the cell's metabolism. They're looking at things that can actually reverse cancer or reverse diabetes. And so a lot of researchers are reverse what is being called HIV or AIDS. So that's the exciting part of this to me, is that once you get away from the constrictions of the allopathic model and you get away from the constrictions of the DNA as the center of the universe model of the cell, and you come out to the energetic model, then you can begin to actually do some healing.
Okay, well, let's take a practical example. As I said, we promised we'd talk about AIDS. So, you know, the history is that gay men and women fought for their liberation in events like Stonewall in the 1970s. And obviously that struggle for acceptance is not over. We saw a man in Alabama who was very anti-gay, Roy Moore. But I think huge gains have been made. But shortly after they achieved liberation, and HIV cut a swath through the population, or at least that's what we're told. But there were some other things happening in the population at that time, and I'll list three that I know of. Paupers, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, which you call T/S.
And yeah, Bactrim, or it's better known in the United States is Bactrim.
Okay.
It's an antibiotic.
Right.
A double folate inhibitor antibiotic.
Right. And there was a hepatitis B vaccine trial focused on gay men as well. So can you talk about those things and what they might have done to the health of the people who were exposed to them?
Yeah, well, the poppers is a nitric oxide and inhalant, which was used early on in the last century for people who had cardiac angina, because it helped to dilate. It's a vessel dilation medication. And the gay population figured out that it had a transient euphoria and was able to help dilate the sphincter of the rectum, so it facilitated rectal penetration. And so it became very popular on the gay scene, the fast-track gay scene, in the late 60s, early 70s.
But particularly in men who are called bottoms, the receptive male partner, right?
Right.
They had a higher consumption of poppers than the people who were classified as the tops.
Right, and it was a carcinogenic agent. It was really the carcinogenic agent that became, I believe, the risk factor for one of the AIDS-defining diseases, which was Kaposi sarcoma.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Kaposi's sarcoma is a disease of the blood vessels, and it expressed itself mainly on the face and in the chest of those guys who were doing a lot of poppers. And so that became one of the AIDS-defining diseases. The other problem is that a lot of these guys, because they had planned to have multiple partners before they went out, they would often take antibiotics to be able to prevent sexually transmitted diseases. And one of those antibiotics was this double folate inhibitor. So now you have poppers, which decrease the antioxidant levels. There is a very stressful oxidant on the system, and it decreases the sulfur levels. Then you have the folate inhibitors, and folate is necessary to regenerate sulfur in the cell. And then what was the third one that you suggested?
Hepatitis B vaccine trials.
Oh, and then it was this vaccine trial that they used this, they generated this vaccine from a lot of people who were very ill. And it wasn't, it really, to have anybody injected with this particular vaccine would have been a tragedy, because the vaccine was taken from people who often they were, you know, they may have been drug addicted, they may have been homeless, they may have been already ill, and they did little to really make sure that that was a safe vaccine, which I'm not sure that you can have a safe vaccine. And they injected that vaccine in a lot of the you know, they suggested that the gay guys take that vaccine at that time. Mm-hmm. So then there was the issue. There was also the issue of a lot of drug taking, a lot of, you know, which are oxidizing agents also. So now you had these exogenous kinds of things that were creating these incredible metabolic imbalances. And it was almost, it was like a prescription for showing up with some kind of incredible immune imbalance, and it did. So, but instead of saying these people are immunologically stressed because of X, Y, and Z, they started looking for viruses.
Well, that's kind of what they do, right? It's like when we had microcephaly in Brazil, instead of looking at the fact that they were putting pesticides in the water supply, that they had a relatively new vaccine trial on pregnant women, there were a number of other potential possibilities. They appear to have just asked the question, which virus? Not, exactly. Is it a virus, but which virus is it? And therefore, the virus with the best evidence, even if that's really, really low, is considered the cause.
But again, one of the things that I started asking about this issue of viruses also, because if you look at the evolution of the cell, one of the things of the eukaryotic cell, you realize that perhaps there are two types of DNA material, two types of nucleic acid material or genetic material. One is called DNA, the other is called RNA. We don't need to talk about what the differences are at this point. It's just a little too complex. But there was no, there until recently, it was thought that the DNA was the first genetic material, but it appears that probably RNA, because it's a little less complex, may have been the first genetic material. Why is this important? It's important because they are saying that viruses are little packets of material that have a little bit of DNA, and then they have a little covering.
A little DNA or RNA?
Sometimes they have DNA, sometimes they have RNA. But for our purposes, we are talking about the RNA viruses, which they say HIV is supposedly an RNA virus.
Okay.
But this is the deal. They don't know what's going on. You know, until recently, they said 90% of the DNA was junk DNA. Mm-hmm. But recent researchers have discovered that the higher the level of the organism, the more RNA or so-called junk DNA that they have. But this RNA, this retrotranscribed RNA into DNA, is actually not junk. It's actually needed for defining the level of complexity of the organism. So when you have a breakdown of a cell because of these reactive oxygen species, you have different expressions of the RNA and the DNA. And sometimes the expression is what is what I believe is being called viruses at this time, because the expression of these particular pieces of DNA are going to be are going to show up under particular metabolic conditions. And so, and once you understand what's happening at the DNA level and at the metabolic level, rather than saying the virus is causing the disease, you can say that the energy imbalance is causing the genome to express particular portions of itself.
Right. Like the way I think of it is if some kind of problem, energy imbalance or whatever it is, exists that causes the production of RNA or DNA that would not normally be present, it'd be very easy to say that that RNA is an external agent and it is the cause of the illness, but in actual fact, it's a consequence of the illness, not a cause. Just because we don't understand what it's for, we say, oh, it's a sexually transmitted virus that, that you got because you're a gay man and you're sexually active, as opposed to the fact that you're a gay man and you're exposed to external agents like poppers, these sulfa drugs, and you know maybe vaccine trials and who knows whatever.
But the point of it is that most of this DNA is dormant until it receives a signal to express itself.
Okay, and the RNA causes that signal.
So no, the energy imbalance causes this. Well, let me just talk a little bit again about the DNA.
Okay.
The DNA, there's DNA and RNA. Much of the DNA in our central genome is what we call retrotranscribed RNA. That is, it starts out as RNA, then it's reverse transcribed by an enzyme into DNA, and then it's inserted into the genome as DNA.
Right, which is essentially what people say happens with an RNA virus.
Exactly.
You take RNA, you reverse transcribe it, you have DNA, and then when you reverse the process, you have that DNA producing more virus. But in this case, you're saying this is part
I'm
of
just
the...
I'm just saying that's a normal part of the process
right.
of the cell.
Right.
And so what I'm just saying is this. The cell has a normal process of how it does things. And first of all, you have a theory. You have a theory that bacteria cause disease. Different bacteria cause different diseases. But then you have other diseases and you can't see the bacteria. And so you posit, well, there must be things that are smaller. And so before you have a light microscope or anything that can actually find these things, you say, oh, they must be viruses.
Well, they call them filterable viruses because they could filter out all the bacteria. And the material, if, say, injected into a mouse brain, would still cause disease. Therefore, there must be an invisible pathogen. Smaller than a bacteria.
Exactly, but the problem is if you don't have a rational theory of how the cell works at the molecular level, you can't posit anything. But they were positing that these outside forces were happening when in fact these are inside forces creating products which, when they are looked at under a microscope, for example, if you look at a cell under a microscope, you might see that it's extruding these little particles. But it's just like any kind of organism. You take things in to make yourself healthy, and you extrude things out that are no longer working.
Mm-hmm.
And so every cell has a way of getting rid of damaged material.
Right.
And so if the cell is, if the material in the cell has been used up and it's damaged by these reactive oxygen species, it gets rid of these things. And if you're looking at it under the microscope, you go like, aha, that's a virus.
Right.
And so, I think that's what has happened.
So another assault on... largely on gay men because they were the target for HIV testing, and the vast majority of the initial so-called AIDS cases were in gay men. Another assault in 1987 was the drug AZT, which is a nucleoside analog, but you also had experience with a drug called, and I'm going to mess up the pronunciation, azathioprine?
Azathioprine.
Yeah. So can you talk about what that was used for and what kind of a drug it was and how it relates to AZT?
Yeah. First of all, azathioprine, like AZT, which came later, both are drugs which were designed. Well, first of all, let's talk about just the people who had transplantation problems. The problem with someone giving somebody a transplant from another human being is that they develop a reaction. Your body has an immune reaction, and it tries to resist this foreign entity which is inside of your body. And so one of the ways that the doctors discovered, Dr. Murray was one of the doctors that I worked with who actually got a Nobel Prize for this. He discovered that there were particular drugs that you could give to help the person from expelling the transplant. But it had a lot to do with suppressing your immune system. And unfortunately, what happened with this azathioprine is when the immune system was suppressed, the patient sometimes developed opportunistic infections and Kaposi sarcomas. And the interesting thing also, because the azathioprine was only one drug, sometimes they were also on steroids and other things. Mm-hmm. But what they found is that occasionally when they stopped the azathioprine, the Kaposi sarcoma, which is a cancer, which sometimes was already stage 3 or stage 4, would completely go away.
Hmm. And azathioprine was a nucleoside analog?
It was a nucleoside analog, and was also chemically related to the AZT.
And AZT is also a nucleoside analog, and
right. But this is the thing with AZT. They knew that AZT they were going to use for a cancer drug, and they all already knew that AZT had a huge toxicity. And the problem is that the thought was, what is a nucleoside analog? We've been talking about DNA. And so the nucleoside would be one of the compounds, the chemicals that are inserted to make DNA. So what you're saying is that this is a product that would replace one of the chemical compounds in DNA.
Right.
But the problem is that the compounds in DNA all have three phosphate additions, and this azathioprine, this AZT, was a monophosphate. It only had one phosphate. And so the fact of the matter is, it never really inserted itself. It just didn't. It didn't work. But what it did do is it attacked the mitochondria. And so this was actually a test. And this is what looked like people were dying so incredibly with AIDS.
What would happen if you wiped out somebody's mitochondria?
Well, the mitochondria, remember, the mitochondria is one of the central places in the cell that makes your a particular type of energy. And so if you wipe out that ATP, the ability of the cell to make ATP, you wipe out the ability of the cell to do what it's supposed to do. That is to keep you alive. And so basically what they were doing was killing these early guys were actually the experiment. And so all of this, the hype about how dangerous AIDS was and the how many people were dying, a lot of it had to do not with the fact that the people had some kind of metabolic imbalance. It had to do with the fact that they were actually being killed by this medicine.
Another connection between azathioprine and AZT, they're both nucleoside analogs. They were both produced by the same company. I guess it was called Burroughs Wellcome back in the 70s and 80s. It's now GlaxoSmithKline. So they should have known that they were giving a drug that was very closely related to a drug that caused Kaposi's sarcoma and opportunistic infections, and they were giving it for a disease that was characterized by Kaposi's sarcoma and opportunistic infections. That just sounds insane to me.
Well, this was the human experiment. Look, the Dr. Thompson at the Memorial Sloan Kettering, he was the senior doctor at the time. They wanted to have a human experimentation to see how particular things were working, without having, again, an understanding of cellular metabolism. So this was a human experiment that was called for. And this time, it was the population, the gay population and the black population that they defined as those people who were having AIDS and HIV who were tested with this drug. And so a lot of people died unnecessarily as a result of this drug.
So what do you think was the purpose of this experiment?
I think it was to see what, look, you know, I am not a psychopath or a sociopath, so I have a really hard time understanding how they think and why they do things. But I think people need to understand that people who are running these things are often sociopaths or psychopaths. And if you want to do a human experimentation and you don't want, or you want to have a particular psychological program on a particular group of people, you can create a crisis and then you can pretend to solve the crisis. So I think this was a way of seeing how much people would take under a particular set of circumstances. For example, what would happen, you know, ever since 9/11, they've had one, every 2 years, they've had some kind of viral crisis, you know, whether it's SARS, H1N1, or whatever. So every 2 years. But what I think the AIDS crisis taught the general public is not to trust, not to be as trusting as they used to be. And so I think this was, part of this was not just, was it a mistake or what we were learning? We were also learning how far we could go with people in getting them to take drugs that actually harm them.
Well, I mean, I think the AIDS idea has been spectacularly successful, and I think that's because it was sexual. West Nile virus, SARS, you know, West Nile virus was supposed to be mosquitoes, and SARS was like human-to-human contact. Somehow that wasn't as scary as the thought that your sexual partner might kill you through a virus that they're carrying. And I think that sort of activated deep-seated fears amongst people, this sort of, you might say, love-hate relationship that people have with sex. They both want it and they fear it. And if you look at magazines, you know, trashy magazines or trashy websites, around the world, you have both this sort of fascination with beautiful people having lots of sex and also, you know, all the bad things that can happen to those people, as if it's sort of punishment, God's punishment for being sexually active.
Well, I think that's a very big part of it. And I think that sort of made it scary for everybody, because it is not a sexually transmitted disease, but they positioned it as a sexually transmitted disease, and that made it very scary for everybody, because now if you position it as a sexually transmitted disease, that means it's not going to be confined to a particular community. It could be everybody's problem.
I mean, by now it should be everywhere, but it's stubbornly stuck within gay men, no matter how much they've tried to make it everybody's problem. And I think, you know, even though most people probably don't question the HIV/AIDS paradigm, I think deep down people know that it's not a problem for, quote, them, unless they're embedded in the gay community, because that's, you know, they just don't see the guy next door dying of AIDS, right? That's highly unlikely.
Right, but the problem is that, especially in the United States, in the work we were doing with Clark Baker and the HIV Innocence Project, is that unfortunately people are still going to jail for being HIV positive and not telling a partner.
Yes, and as we're taping this, the new documentary Criminally False just came out, which talks about the criminalization of HIV. And Ontario and Canada has announced that they're no longer going to be prosecuting people as long as they have a low viral load, which is okay. This is a good segue to what I wanted to talk about, electron microscope evidence. Viral load is supposed to count the number of particles of HIV in your blood. Can we see them with an electron microscope?
Well, first of all, you need to remember one of the things that we already talked about, and that is that your cell is already, you're always going to have particles of RNA and DNA in your blood because mm-hmm. the cell is getting rid of them. So, and depending on how oxidized you are, you're going to have more or less. And so the idea that you can use a PCR test to look at your to evaluate the blood to see how many pieces of genetic material you have and then amplify that to see what the potential is for infection is hopeless. You can't really use it, and the FDA knows that because the package insert says you can't use that test to diagnose.
Right.
And you can't use that test to follow people either, because it has no meaning. The test absolutely has no meaning because the PCR uses fragments of genetic material, and if you have never isolated the genetic material that is supposed to be HIV, then what you're identifying as fragments of HIV in the blood has absolutely no validity.
Right.
Because first you have to know what you're looking at. You have to have it before you can say that you've amplified it.
But there was a hope that people could get electron microscope evidence, and I think there was a little bit of this evidence. But my understanding is when they looked for HIV particles in the blood of HIV positive people, they didn't find the particles that should have been there if the viral load numbers were correct.
Right. So where's Waldo? It's not there.
And that would, I mean, the problem with the viral load test is if they did use it for diagnosis, they would probably find a very low correlation between positive viral load and positive antibody tests, and then that would cause the questioning of both types of tests, because now you're saying, okay, we got two totally distinct tests, they're not giving the same results when they should, are they both wrong, would possibly be a question.
Yeah, but they never, for example, one of the other tests that they use is the CD4 level. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the viral load only predicts about 4% of the CD4. So there's no relationship. So what I'm saying is that there doesn't seem to be any relationship between these tests, the CD4, the antibody, the PCR. If the theory was correct, then all of those tests would correlate in a positive way. And the answer is they don't.
Okay. We're running out of time. I would love to, I think we may have to talk again because we didn't talk about opioids and we didn't talk about cancer and many of the other things in your book, and we don't have time now, but I'll give you the last couple of minutes to try to sort of neatly tie up our conversation today, if that's possible.
This is the point that I've made in this new book, The Slow Death of the AIDS Cancer Paradigm and the Apocrypha of the Eukaryotic Cell. What I want, especially because the book was written for doctors and researchers, because what I want us to begin to have is a different conversation about the cell itself. And if we move away from the gene as the central controlling factor of the cell and go into the energy metabolism of the cell and see how the energy metabolism impacts the expression of the genetic material, we can begin to have a completely different conversation. And we also can begin to understand how we can, when the cell is unbalanced and metabolically unstable, how we can begin to balance the cell through proper nutrition.
Right, which is very important, because even if HIV doesn't cause AIDS, there are still people suffering from compromised immune systems, people coming down with opportunistic infections all the time, and they don't seem to be able to get back to balance. And whenever they go to the doctor, it's fungicides, antiretroviral drugs, potent antibiotics. Those are the solution that they're given. They're not given alternatives.
And especially after 30 years and a literature, if you go to the PubMed and you type in HIV in glutathione, you will find that there are over 700 articles already. And so it's really a crime that the physicians don't even have the ability to go to PubMed and type in glutathione and to begin to replace their patients with some sulfur replacements.
Not replace their patients, but replace their patients' therapy.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
I'm sure they like some of their patients they'd like to replace also.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Nancy.
It was a pleasure, David. Have a great day.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 168 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, thank you, and goodbye.